you wake in a strange room. Your clothes are foreign, and the walls are covered in objects from a different world. You don't know where or when you are, or if you're still dreaming. There are footsteps in the hall. Jumping up, you race out of the room and into the streets. You have just entered the Twilight Histories.
You have entered the Twilight Histories, an audio adventure that casts you as the hero. You are about to journey to Greenland in the late 21st century. Now under the rule of a united Britain and Scandinavia, the colonies on the island are worked to death to extract resources for their imperial overlords. When a major energy project ends in catastrophe, you are sent to investigate. You discover something far worse than any natural disaster. The Depths of Thule is written and produced by Kevin Valbanese. The first part is free. There is a bonus track in our Patreon area if you want to hear more. Stay tuned at the end of the show to hear details on how you can listen to that. A quick word before we get started. I was on vacation in Hawaii with my family recently, a world away from Greenland in the late 21st century. We were just about to drive off to see some waterfalls. As the kids were getting in the car, I ran a quick search for podcasts, hoping to find some stories about Hawaii, so we'd have something to listen to. I found this great podcast by a local Hawaiian who creates fantastic mythological stories set all over the Pacific, from New Zealand to Japan to the Pacific Northwest. The podcast is called Legends of the Pacific. I picked a few stories set in Hawaii, and off we went. And I tell you, these stories are fantastic. The podcaster, Kamuela Kaneshiro, is a great writer, and he has this deep, dramatic voice, and he mixes it in sounds and music just like a Twilight History show. My wife thought he could be my long-lost Hawaiian brother. So I recommend you go and check out this podcast. It's called Legends of the Pacific. You won't regret it. And now, on to today's show. This is Depths of Thule by Kevin Valbanese.
The world has many secrets. We took to the stars, mapped galaxies, captured the spectral outlines of black holes, all before we even truly understood what lurked in the depths of our oceans. Even now, we uncover caverns that never once offered shelter to a living soul. And the ice, well, as far as the frigid veil still stretches, it doubtless conceals natural wonders from eons long forgotten. I must admit, I was surprised to see your request land on my desk. Oddly enough, the polar reaches tend to be for those looking for a more tropical escape. People quite enjoy skirting around the legs of Antarctic sauropods rather than cozying up with penguins on the icy shores. There are the odd few chasing pyramids and U-boat docks under the glacial sheets, but you certainly don't strike me as that type. Oh, but don't worry. I do have something that should satisfy your particular needs. Greenland, in the late 21st century. Wars in Eastern Europe and a climate hell-bent on scourging any settlement north of the 50th parallel definitely realigned the great powers of this world. The North Sea Empire reigned supreme over the world's crown in this timeline. A desperate United Kingdom joined with the Scandinavian powers to exploit passageways opening up in the Arctic Circle. Like the Tyrians and Phoenicians of old, They established trading colonies in coves and inlets revealed by the retreating glaciers. And when they were able to tap previously inaccessible oil and natural gas deposits, well, let's just say their navy tripled in size. But then, slowly, the ice returned. A long, unending winter set in, cutting off the laneways and stranding the fledgling colonies. Only those still able to extract oil or gas were maintained, and the great engineers of London and Stockholm struggled to hold back the advancing glaciers as nature proved itself more than a match for human ingenuity. In time, the unending snow would almost completely bury the colonies, and the ice blocked even the mightiest of ships from crossing the waves. Tunnels and pipelines were the best man could muster at this point. Those colonies not completely abandoned or lost were linked together under the mounting snow and ice. So, as long as something could be pumped to heat homes back in the heart of the Empire, the effort was still worth it. As for the condemned souls still living in those icy islands and remote enclaves, well, life is a struggle, to put it mildly. Still interested? All right, then. If you head over to the staging area, you'll find clothing and equipment for your journey. Please suit up while I finish your orientation. We're sending you to the most far-flung of the North Sea Empire's colonies, the aforementioned Greenland. Once granted autonomy from its Danish overlords, the island nation was once again placed under the authority of the crown, and later made an imperial territory. A dense network of colonies and tunnels crisscrossed the island, all dedicated to mining rare earth minerals and what natural gas they can tap. But after the long winter set in, Greenland has become all but isolated, and the situation in the colonial outposts is deteriorating. Attempts to stabilize a precarious energy shortage were dashed due to an incident at the yet unfinished Bjørn reactor and its accompanying outpost, Tula Subcity. Now, resources are beginning to grow scarce, and the people are becoming desperate. To avoid an outright revolt, the North Sea Empire is dispatching an advanced team to assess the damage at the reactor and at Tula Subcity. You will join that team as the eyes and ears of the operation. Your role will be to document the site and prepare a report for the Imperial authorities. I would advise you to stick to your work and avoid getting involved with the rest of the team. There is already bad blood between the Inuit of Greenland and the Anglo-Scandinavian colonists, but being crammed together in the cities with little food or water is not helping things at all, even among the best of colleagues. Now then, let's have a look at you. Very nice. Very tactical. You might be a little warm now, but believe me, you'll be grateful for the lining and the layers once you touch down in Greenland. Go ahead and step onto the platform, and we'll get you on your way. Hell is often depicted as a fiery pit, with Lucifer's envious throne perched atop an igneous mound, ringed by a raging torrent of magma. Deep beneath man's unwitting feet, the legions of the fallen delight in their sadistic duty, flaying, searing, and rending the damned. But perhaps Dante had the lowest circle right after all. Maybe the domain of the supreme traitor is a gloomy, frigid cage snaring the forsaken oathbreakers in its icy grasp. As you strain your eyes and search the endless sea of white, you fancy that your wandering gaze might stumble upon the hopeless gate to those nether realms. You've certainly been lost here long enough, wandering the meandering corridors and tunnels, cursing the folly that led you to this snow-besieged prison. Hope has all but abandoned you, leaving you with little to do but peer out at the wintry wastes and await a guide who might never come. 2 weeks now, you've shuffled up from the rigid cot you call home, and after partaking in the forsaken brew known as the King's Cod, you've hauled yourself up to the observation deck and peered out the window. The view is fluid, its exact contours shifting and yet, dreadfully, unchanging. Snow stretches out as far as the eye can see, perpetually disturbed by the savage winds which sweep over the pale expanse. If there is a horizon, you've never seen it, for the violent storm is unyielding and the powdery haze so thick that even the sun's disk is impossible to make out. A few of the malfunctioning panels scattered around the observation deck brag about how it's exactly the same height as the famed Step Pyramid of Djoser. You find that fact utterly alarming, since the snow is but a few feet away from covering the lower parts of the panoramic window. Even if you can't notice it day to day, you have no doubt this entire place could be buried within a year or two at most. But hopefully, you won't be sticking around that long. Wiping away the dust from one of the panels, you check the time and find the day is basically burnt. You sigh and prepare yourself for another night of shoveling back cheap stew in the graveyard that currently passes for a cafeteria. You make for the elevator, in no particular hurry. Just then, the elevator doors slide open, and out steps a man easily twice your size, or at least, your thickness. You've seen little more than the man's shadow for the last few weeks, as if he had been a figment of your weary imagination when you first materialized in the bowels of the colony. You wonder if you're seeing things now, because this veritable giant is wearing the same disintegrating cable-knit sweater and ripped blue jeans that he did when you first met him. As you feel his hot, stale breath on your face, you in fact find yourself all too rooted in reality.
There you are! I almost didn't believe it when Johan said you'd been coming up here so much. I don't know why you would. You can definitely beat this view.
Oh, well, there's not much else to do, is there?
Oh, I don't know about that. There's plenty of work to do if we're talking about keeping this old tin can going. Contrary to what they might tell you in London or Oslo, or wherever it is you're from, this place does not run itself.
I suppose, but I feel like I would have just been in the way. This time, a thick arm wraps itself around your shoulder, and the big guy pulls you in for a squeeze that's just a little too tight. You can smell a hard day's work on him, but as you look up, his rosy cheeks and glossy brown eyes make the moment a little more bearable.
Ah, it's all good. We'll just say that you've been saving your energy up for the big job. Speaking of which, you'll be happy to know that the wait is probably over. We're heading out tonight. If we're lucky.
He presses a button, opening the elevator doors. You're practically swept off your feet as he leads you into the cramped elevator car. Sweet relief washes over you, and you don't even spare the bleak expanse another glance as the elevator door slams shut with a thud. You reach out and press the B button at the bottom of the display panel. The car groans for a moment, then begins its slow descent. For once, you can't reach the bottom soon enough.
It's Tonrak, by the way,
says the big guy, looking over at you with his brow furrowed and his eyes narrow.
Oh, yeah, I knew that.
He smiles and gives you a hearty swat on the back.
Ah, you forgot. But I promise you, no way you'll forget it by the end of this little escapade.
You crack a nervous laugh, which is quickly overtaken by the bellowing hoots and haws erupting from deep within this mountain of a man. All you can think in that moment is that it's going to be a long ride down. A few minutes later, you watch the numbers on the display panel tick closer and closer to the basement. Tonrak is going on about a less than terrible spot to grab some fish soup. Apparently, the dish has become quite the luxury, despite Greenland being an island surrounded by the freezing waters of the Atlantic. At least, in your timeline. You guess the ice sheet has moved far enough south that safe harbors to launch from have become quite rare, and fishing vessels, quite a bit more rare indeed. Just a floor or two to go now, but as you reach and climb down past the ground floor, the elevator car shakes. You can hear the shaft above groaning, and you fear that the cable will snap. Thankfully, the elevator touches down at the basement level, though with a bit of a thump. Not even condescending to try the button, Tonrak presses his thick fingers between the two doors, and with a growl, he begins to pry them open until the mechanism finds purchase and draws them back the rest of the way. You squeeze past Tonrak, desperate to get on solid ground, and for a moment, you struggle to steady your breath. At best, you probably dropped a foot or two, but the sharpness of the drop still did your innards no favors. And now, as you're trying your best to find equilibrium, the world shudders and shakes again, nearly causing you to keel over. Thankfully, Tonrak snatches you by the waistband and pulls you back onto your feet.
"The hell is going on?"
he shouts as he squats down into a steadier stance, motioning for you to do the same. His eyes whip around, taking stock of the situation. But no sooner than the tremor began, it ceases with one final heave. Dust and debris rains down from the ceiling, but nothing larger than a pebble.
"Are you all right?"
"Yeah, I think so. You?" Tonrak dusts himself off and pulls a few stones from the wiry tears in his sweater. For the first time since you've seen him, the warm and jolly grin gives way to a cool, wide-eyed grimace. He steps over and gives you a once-over, pulling your limbs this way and that, as if he was handling a tool he'd just dropped. I said I'm good. Immediately, his face lights up again, and he clamps a dusty palm against the back of his head.
"Sorry, I think my brain got a little bit rattled there."
You push past Tonrak, doing your best to look steady and stable. Your stomach threatens to eject the lunch that just went down poorly enough, and so you press your hand over your mouth just in case.
"Are you sure you're okay?"
You wave back, doing your best to get the big guy off your case. Finally, you come up upon a guardrail, and you lean over it right away, taking deep breaths until your gut finally calms down. You straighten yourself out, standing tall, finally able to take in your surroundings. A dull, red glow covers everything, and a bassy siren rings out across the depths. These last 2 weeks, you'd always been greeted by a dim and indistinct vista, with shadows smearing the contours of every structure so that it all seemed to be in a monochromatic smear. But now, you see the bowels of this thonic metropolis rendered in detail that would inspire Florence's poet supreme to pen a fresh inferno. Ragnarsland's subcity is a vision of necessity. Blasted and carved out of the Earth's crust, the reinforced vaulted ceiling holds back unimaginable pressure. Vast columns help to bear the weight of rock, ice, and snow pressing ever down on this sunless refuge. And now, in the gloomy glow, you can see the apartments built into the side of the vast columns, each barely wide enough at a glance to be considered comfortable. Space is obviously at a premium here, and as you search the cityscape, you find that principal concern addressed at every corner. A dense network of subway tracks weave throughout the spaces between apartment blocks, no doubt depriving the residents of lasting peace and quiet. Vast cable bridges stretch across the depths, linking the largest and tallest structures together in a veritable spider's web. Pipes and exhausts ring the exterior, all snaking upward and through the rock, no doubt to pump toxic fumes up and away from the fragile pocket and to replenish the very stale air. A central lake takes pride of place among the dingy, metallic expanses. The waters are relatively still, and save for one bridge facilitating a central subway line, the lake remains free of man-made structures, with even its rocky shores enjoying several feet of clearance before the walls of squat apartments and walkways begin. Up above, several gargantuan lamps cling to the ceiling, though their light is dim and several have burned out. The whole array is barely able to rival the thousands of pitiful emergency lights now dotting the city, and you find it miraculous that you've even been able to find your way around this man-made abyss. Doubtless, the darkness will be even more pervasive now, since it appears that one of the lanterns has shattered as a result of the tremor.
We better hurry, says Tonrak. I got a bad feeling this might change things for the job, but we won't know until we meet the rest of the team.
He gestures down the narrow stairway which leads into the shadowy streets below.
Your place isn't too far from you, right? We'll stop by and grab your things, just in case.
You nod, and without further delay, you begin your descent. You move among the dark and narrow streets of Ragnar's Land, clutching the strap of your duffel bag in one hand and a heavy pelican case in the other. Tonrak leads the way, himself carrying several packs and satchels, and one big pelican case of his own. Down here, far below the pale warmth of the warning lights, it is difficult to find one's way, save for the odd LED sign flickering in the darkness. The alleyways and even the main road here are so bereft of any luminance that you think you're drifting into the midst of a stellar void, or perhaps towards the event horizon of a black hole. Even with your destination clearly in mind, you feel as if you're wandering aimlessly, doomed to drag your feet in penance for all eternity. The denizens of Ragnar's Land, those brave enough to venture outside their miserable homes, look like shades lumbering on unwittingly towards Charon's hateful shores. They are all dressed in long coats, hoods drawn up, all of them well-worn and caked with dirt. You'd think they were trying to look like specters. Every now and then, one of them risks a furtive glance in your direction, revealing pale white skin and, usually, icy blue or green eyes. You recall that Greenland had long been a possession of the Danish crown, and that its imperial successor had renewed its colonial ambitions on the island. And you wonder at how these transplants from Scandinavia were adjusting to the bleak world below the surface. What promises had coaxed them from their hearths back in Oslo or Copenhagen, you wonder? And how did they feel now that their imperial sponsors had left them to toil for their meager sustenance in the midst of an endless sea of white? Rounding a corner, you and Tonrak find yourself at the base of a great stairway, flanked on either side by escalators. Sadly, the mechanized steps are frozen in place, like everything else currently under alert. You let out a deep sigh, which Tonrak parrots, but he points up to the top of the stairs where a bright white light pours out from between two large doors. It's not quite the end of the tunnel, but it'll do. Reaching the top, you plop yourself down for a moment to catch your breath, wiping a thick sheet of sweat from your brow. Tonrak, the big guy that he is, demonstrates remarkable resilience, merely leaning against the handrail and brushing a few droplets of sweat from his wispy mustache. Embarrassed, you pull yourself up and hurry past the doors, practically crossing into another world. You squint as you are immediately confronted by an array of intense fluorescent lights, their pale glow bolstered by the polished steel surfaces covering every wall and angle within. As your eyes adjust, you spy an array of monitors hanging from the ceiling, a dazzling display of orange, yellow, and red characters dancing about, conveying warnings and notices of severe delays and cancellations. Below the endless screens is a concourse, comprising three levels, each flowing down to the next by means of lifts and escalators. There are shops, cantinas, and kiosks in every direction, many locked behind thick metal gates, or simply empty, though several are still open and are currently flooded by a sea of angry commuters, many of whom are hissing and cursing about the delays. You see a good mix of Northern Europeans and of the indigenous Inuit, all dressed for long days at hard jobs, and now crushing against each other as they hunt for station attendants in search of answers. Tonrak presses through the crowd, leading you down a level via the escalator, mercifully the only one that's still working. Taking a right, he leads you into one of the few cantinas, the Mother of the Deep, still open on the second level, with a sizable place fashioned in the shape of a semi-dome. The central bar is completely bereft of any liquor, and instead has been retrofitted into an open kitchen. You hear the crackle of fritters and catch the aroma of fried fish wafting in the air. A small troop of Inuit women work tirelessly behind the counter, preparing generous cuts of seal meat and blubber alongside mashed potatoes, heaps of fish roe, and bowls of stew, while others attempt to set the decor in order after the earlier tremor. You shake your head and curse yourself for not exploring the city more. The hellhole you had been frequenting was cheap and close to the observation deck, but this place is practically an oasis, and at a glance, the company is much better, though the prices likely demand it. You join Tonrak at the back of the joint, near a pair of double doors which lead to the main kitchen. As you sit down, one of the women from behind the counter approaches to take your order. Tonrak plops his hand down over the menu and shakes his head. He turns to the woman and fires off in Greenlandic. She taps rapidly into her tablet, and before you know it, she's scooping up your menus and hurrying away. A few moments later, just as you are finishing up your meal, a conspicuous pair walk up to your table, both of them hauling quite large backpacks. One is a woman in her late 40s, or perhaps her early 50s. It's hard to tell because of the scowl she's wearing and the unnaturally silver cast to her hair. The other is a younger gentleman, barely out of his 30s, and with something of an aloof air about him. You also notice a large cross hanging from his neck, simple but still glimmering in gold.
Ah, there we are.
Tonrak stands up and offers a hand to the pair. The younger gentleman reaches out and shakes with glee, while the woman simply nods.
Oh, where are my manners?
He gestures to the new arrivals.
This here is Dr. Anya Ingbird. She's a professor of geology over at Gothenburg University, if I remember correctly.
She nods.
And this here is Matthias Groningen, the best security technician this side of Ragnar's land.
He means to say hacker. Or he should say reformed hacker and part-time shepherd to the good lord's flock. He crosses himself to make the point, then bursts into laughter.
Believe me, I know. But spreading the wisdom of the word is not so profitable these days.
Learning to code proved much more lucrative than seminary ever did.
You offer a nod and a smile to the curious pair, and then picking up your stuff, you look around at the crowd still swarming about, enraged at the ongoing suspension of service. So, how are we getting to the job site? Are we still going to the job site? I don't think the trains are going to be running for a while. Anya scoffs and flashes her ID badge, which means nothing in particular to you. Seeing that her flex is lost on you, she sighs and leans in, finger pointed at you like a scolding Sunday school teacher.
We're not just some hapless commuters. There's work to be done. And emergency or not, we're departing in 10 minutes. So, we'd better get a move on.
You pace about, tinkering with one of the two drones that you've packed for the trip. You find this bit of retro tech charming, and you're looking forward to taking it for a spin in the empty halls of Tula Subcity. The thing almost looks like a beetle, and you could imagine someone getting startled as its triple turret lenses drop down from above or zoom out from the shadows. Replacing the drone in its case, you find yourself confronted by the awkward monotony of the train interior. The ride is so smooth, and without a single window to see the icy exterior or the shadowy tunnel passing by, so really, you can't even be sure if you're moving at all. The polished white of the interior and the lack of even an advertisement make this car better suited to the inmates of an asylum than your average commuter. Even Tonrak looks bored out of his mind, half asleep with his big boots resting on his pelican case. He lets slip the odd snore before rousing himself awake again, earning a less than enthusiastic glance from Anya. This little show repeats itself 3 or 4 times before Anya pushes her way past you and Matthias and takes up the furthest seat she can away from Tonrak. The abbot shakes his head and then returns his gaze to the pages of an old, tattered Bible, just small enough to fit in one's pocket. He looks intensely at the impossibly small font, squinting from behind his thick glasses. You glance over and find a title not familiar to you. He's reading the Book of Giants. He notices you peering over and spins the book around in his palm, offering it to you.
You must find me a bit annoying. I always hated people carrying on about their vinyl records and how analog is the way.
You take up the Bible and flip it over to the table of contents, finding it filled with the names of texts you're sure you've never heard of in your life.
It's the last collection of the Apocrypha and the Pseudepigrapha that the Catholic Church ever committed to paper. Nobody ever thought to make the entirety of the text available online, funny enough.
That seems like a curious oversight, you say.
Sadly, no. The decade this was published in was tumultuous, to say the least. They never even got around to translating some of the fragments archaeologists dug up in Aswan. Word was, they might have filled in some of the more frustrating lacunae in the Greek apocalypse of Peter. So, sadly, it's just a few hundred of these that they printed and bound.
Well, I don't suppose there's anything useful in here for the job we're on now.
Oh, gosh, no. You just need to pass the time down here, and the fanciful visions of hell, angels, and all that do well enough, at least for me. It beats reading programming guides, I'll tell you that.
You flip through the book a bit more, a touch disappointed by the lack of any pictures. Still, the odd bit of text you register is enough to stir the imagination. The ancients certainly were obsessed with the fiery doom that awaited mankind's sinful masses. Giving Mateus' Bible back, you walk around, looking for your next distraction. You wander over to the front of the car, and on cue, a monitor drops down from the ceiling to display your progress towards Tula Station. You're a little over 3/4 of the way, which is a relief. But with how long it's taken you to get there already, you know the escape from boredom is still further off than you'd like. You consider striking up a conversation with Anya, but the energy she exudes is palpable from across the car. She just sits there, arms crossed, scowling. For someone who, according to Tonrak, is supposed to be in charge, she's not doing much to motivate her team, or even take the time to go over the mission in detail. Tonrak's comments about this potentially being a long haul, spoken just as you boarded the train, bolstered by the heaps of equipment piled up around the seats of the car, do begin to wear on your mind. Clearly, there's something that your supposed leader is not telling you about the job, but then you can probably just chalk that up to poor management. After all, she did keep you waiting weeks for a mission that should have been an in-and-out, especially given the nature of the emergency that took place at Tula, or at least the urgency at which the authorities wanted this place explored. And now, with flawless timing, she's sending you rushing over to that site immediately after a tremor has rocked the area. You try your best to get a read on Anya, but she just looks back with cold, pitiless eyes. That's a mistake you won't soon repeat. Even as you turn your eyes away and pretend not to have looked at all, you can hear her scoffing from the other side of the car. You consider going back to speak with the abbot, or rousing Tonrak from his semi-nap, but as you do, you feel the train shudder. You tumble over, rolling over Tonrak's pelican case, crashing into your own bags. Something solid in your bag presses up against your ribs, causing you to gasp out in pain. As you roll over, you feel the train shudder again, and this time, Mateus goes flying, but he catches hold of a handrail and spins around, slamming into a seat at an awkward angle. Tonrak and Anya likewise pop off of their seats, but the tremor is only so strong as to toss them a couple of feet. Equipment spills from the seats and bags and empties out onto the floor. And then, with one final massive shudder, the lights go out and the train comes to a sudden stop, jolting you all forward and sending you tumbled over the spilled goods and sending you tumbling over the spilled goods until you crash and black out. Your eyes open onto darkness, interrupted only by the faint flicker of fluorescent lights. You immediately sit up, and a searing pain in your side causes you to cry out. You press a hand against your side and find the area tender. You undo your liner and run a hand up your shirt, drawing it back, relieved to at least find it dry. With some effort, you push aside a pack and grab hold of a handrail, heaving yourself up and onto your feet. As soon as you're standing up, you can tell that the train came to rest at an angle, with much of the debris piled up to the right side. The hull is largely intact, though the monitor screens are all spiderwebbed, and a few of the handrails near you look slightly bent out of shape. Your companions all lay on the floor, unconscious, crumpled over packs, cases, and whatever else came loose during the initial shock. Spotting Tonrak, you shuffle over and reach out, intent on shaking him awake. But, as you draw closer to your fallen friend, you notice something just behind him. The pelican case that Tonrak had been hauling around lays wide open on the floor, its contents in total disarray. One in particular jutting out from its foam insert at an angle. It's a bullpup assault rifle of unknown make and model, bulky with a thick shoulder stock and a silencer fixed to the muzzle. Peering closer to the case, You can see a number of spare magazines and a Glock laying on the foam above their inserts. You stumble back, tripping over Mateus. The abbot wakes with a gasp, clutching his back where your boot had just left a clear print. He pulls himself up, giving way to every curse under the sun.
Jesus, Maria, and all the goddamn saints. Can you watch where you're going, please?
You try to calm Mateus down, but it's too late. His furious bellowing rouses both Anya and Tonrak.
Is everyone okay?
Tonrak looks right at you, his eyes wide with genuine concern. But your shock must be palpable, because the blood drains from his face, and he whips around to see his formerly concealed weapon.
Hey, now, let's talk about this, okay?
Tonrak puts his hands up, palms facing you in a gesture of good faith. What kind of job are we doing exactly? You grab Mateus by the sleeve and try to pull him back too, but he shakes you off. Don't tell me you're in on this too, you say, your voice trembling.
Ah, listen, man, look, you're the odd one out here. You got recommended out of nowhere for this job. Sorry if we left out one minor detail before we got on site, okay?
Mateus unzips his coat and reveals a holstered Glock of his own. You look over at Anya, and she too reveals a concealed weapon under her jacket. Tonrak puts the rifle and everything else back into the case, snapping it shut. He stands up and again comes forward with open arms. With Mateus right next to you and Anya glaring from behind Tonrak, you don't think it wise to make a fuss. Tonrak places his meaty hands on your shoulders and looks you right in the eyes.
The job is, it's a little more complicated. This year, all of this year, this is just for our safety, okay?
Tonrak pulls a Glock from inside of his jacket and offers it to you. Looking around, you find Mateus and Anya staring at you with intent. Intent to do what? You don't know.
You'll understand when you get there, okay?
You decline the weapon, which seems to put Anya and Mateus at ease. Tonrak slides the weapon back into his hidden holster, and then steps over to the panel at the end of the car.
Well, at least we're almost there. See?
He points to the cracked screen, still displaying your progress along the tunnel.
Shouldn't we just wait for help?
Nope, he replies. Tula is right there. We go, we send a distress signal from there, and we do as much of the job as we can while help heads our way. That's the plan, and we're gonna stick to it.
Without another word, Mateus and Anya get to work, packing up what supplies they can. You just stand there, unsure of what to do, or frankly, who to trust.
Hey, come on. We gotta get moving.
You don't budge.
Aw, come on.
Aren't you at least curious about what's down there in Tula?
Within the span of a few minutes, you're clambering down from the train car, through doors that Tonrak has forced open. And, mindful of the rails, you catch packs thrown from the train and lay them out onto a safety platform running down the length of the tunnel. Taking the absolute minimum, you begin your trek down the safety platform, pausing only a moment to look back at the derailed train. The tunnel is dark, as expected, with visibility maintained only by the dim glow of red warning lights embedded in the ceiling and along the tracks. A light layer of frost clings to every surface, warranting caution with every step you take. At the very least, the platform is sturdy, and you aren't exactly going to get lost. The way is long, and the march is quiet. The sound of your boots echo in the tunnel as you trudge on, not a word passing between any of you. All you can do, as you follow Tonrak's heavy steps, is keep an eye on the pelican case held tight in his grip. You can't help but wonder at what sort of inspection you're meant to undertake at Thula Subcity, or the reactor beyond it. The thought haunts you,
lingering like a vengeful phantom, all the way until you finally reach the end of the line. Approaching the end of the tunnel, you find a safety door standing in your way, a large circular lock guarding the way into Tula, with its thick, interlocking components like the hands of a giant forestalling the passage of all who might approach the frigid shores of Lake Cocytus. The door might just be a measure to prevent a speeding train from blasting into the station, or it could have been put in place to seal off the catastrophe that took place in this remote colony. Either way, the frost-ridden metal gives off an aura of sheer malice, as if the old serpent himself was coiled up behind it. Tonrak pulls open a panel on the wall and finds a series of levers. One by one, he pulls them down, fighting the buildup of ice to lock them in place. Every time he yanks one down, a great clanging resounds throughout the tunnel. And in response, something clicks within the gate. On the third and final lever, the mechanism holding the gate together unlocks and draws back, opening onto a darkness so thick that it's almost material. You hurl your drone up in the air, and in an instant, the compact brick unfolds, extending its arms and immediately activating its propellers. You tighten the wrist-mounted controller around your arm and punch in a series of commands. The body of the drone unleashes four wide, intense beams of light, cutting through the darkness and providing you your first proper look at the interior of Tula Station. You're standing on a platform, quite unfinished, but with a cool, polished stone floor and a number of half-installed standing displays. Seating is sparse, and the ceiling lets its guts hang out, with cables, panels, and signage dangling above your heads. A pair of escalators lead up into the concourse above, but even then, they look frosted over and quite treacherous to climb. Taking a moment, Tonrak pops open his pelican case and takes up his rifle, fixing a flashlight to the mount under the barrel. He also pulls a pair of goggles from his jacket, and satisfied that the cracks are only at the edges of the frame, he slides them on and taps the side, activating a decently powerful torch built into the sides of the glasses. Mateus and Anya pull their own goggles from their packs and put them on before checking that their Glocks are in working order. You look around, but cannot find a pair of goggles for yourself. Tonrak pulls out a spare pair from his jacket and tosses them to you. He also offers you the pistol from before with some urgency. Anya and Mateus shake their heads, but Tonrak insists, dropping the weapon into your open palms.
Okay, look here. This is the safety. You keep that on until I tell you. Not a second sooner. Okay?
You nod and slide the weapon into one of your jacket's inner pockets.
We're here to survey the damage, alright? That's what the boss lady says. The brief is the same. We just don't know if anyone else is snooping around here. Could be the Russians, could be the Americans. Either way, both shoot first, so we will too.
I'm not much of a shot, you say. Is there anything else I can do? Do your job, Anya sneers. Record everything you see. And while you're at it, be careful about how you're whipping that drone around. We need clear footage, but we can't give away our location either.
I'm sorry, but how the hell am I supposed to manage that? I have to fly this thing high enough for us to actually see anything, not to mention the camera, and, well, you know, we need to leave lights on at least a little bit.
That's your problem, newbie. Anya shoves past you, causing the bruise in your side to flare up. You groan and curse under your breath, but she just keeps going, heading to the escalators to assess their safety.
The ice isn't too bad. Let's get moving. Shouldn't you be whispering? You regret letting those words slip between your lips. But before Anya can come storming back, Donrak signals for everyone else to get moving. He glances back at you, shaking his head and winks as if to say, I know. Taking control of the drone again, you adjust the brightness to the bare minimum, rendering visibility good at least 10 feet ahead of you, and you reduce the altitude of the drone itself to roughly 5 feet. Sending the drone ahead up the ramp, you find the landing clear, and with a thumbs up to Tonrak, you all begin to climb up. Reaching the top, you send the drone hovering along the ground until it comes up against a low wall. You move the drone up until it can just peer over the wall, but you can see nothing out there. Well, I can't say it's clear, but it's too dark for anyone else to spot us, or whatever that's worth. That's apparently good enough for Tonrak, because he signals for everyone to advance while keeping low. You all take up your positions against the wall and cautiously peer over the ledge. Flashlights cutting through the darkness, though at no great distance, and weapons pointed ahead. The concourse must be vast, far larger than that of Ragnar's Land Station. You can see little more than the polished floor and the odd puddle of icy water in every direction. Unnerved, Tonrak motions at the drone, directing you to send it up. You comply, allowing it to climb higher and higher, ascending at least 50 feet in the air before its light reflects off the polished steel panels of the ceiling. Looking to Tonrak, he signals to wait. Then, he directs Anya and Mateus to cover left and right respectively, while he aims dead center. Then, he gives you the thumbs up, and motions for you to crank the lights. The drone shines like the evening's first star as you crank the brightness. The little machine's light bounces off the radiant ceiling panels, giving off illumination far surpassing what you were expecting. A diffuse but sufficient glow settles over the concourse, revealing the vastness of the interior. Without a doubt, the concourse is at least twice as broad as any of the levels in Ragnar's Land Station. Feeling all the more spacious for the utter lack of anything, save for the few chairs installed near the back. Around the perimeter, empty spaces wait hopelessly for merchants who will never set up shop within their walls. It's a void, little more than a man-made cave. Tonrak waits long enough for any concealed assailants to take a pot shot, and when no soul answers the easy challenge, he shoulders his rifle and stands up.
I think we're good. If someone's hanging around, they aren't here.
He gives you a pat on the shoulder and points across the room to where two sets of stairs, each guarded by a low rail, cling to the wall and lead up and away from the massive pair of doors which actually lead into the station.
I've got a good feeling the control room's up there. If we're lucky, there might still be some power stored somewhere. Maybe we can get some cameras going, see if anyone's made camp. If everything looks clear, maybe we can even turn the lights on.
Y'all get moving, advancing under the light of the drone. Everyone hops over the leftmost gate, except for Tonrak, who just busts the lock and pulls it open to waltz on through. Ascending the stairs, you draw the drone closer to you, just in case you need to send it in first. Mateus takes up his position at the door, while Anya prepares to open it. On the silent count of three, Anya forces the door open and Mateus goes in, his Glock raised. Anya follows him in, and then Tonrak joins them. The all-clear comes a minute later. You recall the drone, allowing it to fold up in your palm and go dark. Heading inside, you follow the corridor past several offices and service rooms until you reach a long corridor midway between the entrance you came through and the other. You see the light from everyone else's goggles and head in to join them, unable to quite make out what's at the end until you are literally standing at the threshold to the room. The light from your goggles reveals only the foremost part of the room, a set of rows, which doubtless stretch on at some distance, given how far you can spot the light from your team's equipment appearing and disappearing behind clean, solid lines. These are servers in front of you. Dozens of them. All dormant behind their glass cases. All feeding into a mess of cables running underneath the transparent floor. Following the cables, you advance down the central walkway, reaching the dormant brain of the station. A control panel stretching 10 feet in either direction, replete with switches, screens, and multiple keypads, this interface could doubtless run an entire city with sufficient power. You find it almost absurd that you were able to just walk in here. But then, Tula was never quite finished, was it? And the builders clearly had not implemented security features before the disaster struck. Mateus holsters his pistol, cracks his fingers, and pumps up his shoulders. He looks like a kid in a candy shop, practically skipping as he fetches a fallen chair and slides over to the main panel. It's time to do the Lord's good work. He runs his hands over the panel, finally reaching a switch kept under a glass cover. He holds his goggles up at an angle to make the embossed text at the base of the box legible. It reads, Power. Mateus claps two hands together and rubs his palms against each other. Say your prayers, ladies and gentlemen. Everyone waits with bated breath, except for Anya, who sneers at the joke. A little deflated, Mateus pops the cover of the switch and flicks it without further ceremony. Let there be... forget it. Everyone waits for a long, drawn-out beat as the darkness persists, and silence saps away any hope of finishing the mission, or getting help for that matter. Mateus slumps over the control panel, letting slip a long, drawn-out sigh. You can't help but reach out to offer a comforting hand, but Tonrak beats you to it, half pummeling the poor abbot as he claps him on the back. Standing there awkwardly with your hand outstretched, you glance over at the switch and notice something Mateus missed. 3 primary switches lay to the side of the main power switch. All turn to the left and with a helpful embossed line indicating a connection to the main switch. You flick the main power back into the off position, and then you flip the 3 primers. You look over at Mateus and make the sign of the cross in jest before flipping the main switch. Again, a long, uncomfortable beat as everyone waits desperately for something to happen. And then, with little more than a click and a faint hum to mark it, the control panel lights up, its monitors flickering to life and giving off a dim, half-dead glow. Well, 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 the Lord does work in mysterious ways. Mateus spins around, expecting a chuckle, but the best anyone can offer is a shrug of the shoulders. You guys are no fun. Scowling, he spins back around and begins to type furiously into the main keypad, prompting commands to fill the main monitor. The only thing you can make sense of is a line of code, indicating that total power reserves are currently at 8%. You could have guessed from the fact that barely anything else is switched on besides the panel and a few of the server towers, and the depressing dimness of the monitors themselves is a dead giveaway too. Either way, it's doubtful that there's enough power on hand to light up the entirety of the city, however much of it there's actually left. At the very least, you hope this is more than enough energy to send out a signal for help. Mateus enters a few more commands and brings up a menu for the various facility functions. Schedules, safety, intranet, security, and communications. A pop-up message warns that one or more functions may be compromised due to insufficient power.
All right, Tonrak says as he points a thick finger at the monitor. Can you bring up the cameras?
Mateus enters the command, but he immediately gets a warning that there is insufficient power to turn on all the cameras.
Huh? Ah, damn it. Well, turn on what you can.
Mateus types away furiously, and in a moment, a large monitor descends from the ceiling and brings up an array of camera feeds. most of which display little more than dark, grainy images of empty rooms, corridors, and what you think are streets or alleyways. Not exactly all-seeing, but that's it. Not a soul huddled around a fire or a radiator. Mateus points to a few blank spots in the camera feeds, most of which have a label reading reactor. Now, that I find strange, Mateus says as he points to a series of camera feeds labeled Reactor Core. Rather than a blank feed, the video displays a strange cascade of digital noise. Bands of pixels and artifacting washing back and forth like waves on a shore. There's something interfering with the signal to the camera. Look, look carefully. The waves match, or at least their timing does. But it's not perfect, they're not exact duplications. Everyone draws closer, trying to verify what Mateus is asserting. This isn't just noise. The cameras are registering something. They're registering movement. I'm sure of it.
Well, looks like we do have some unwanted guests after all.
Donrak taps the screen.
Okay, now, how do we actually get there?
Mateus closes out the camera feed and brings up a map of Thula substation and the city beyond it. There's a clear egress from the station to a yard servicing the reactor. And at a glance, there's a service platform you can all use to access it.
Send a message back to Ragnar's land. We'll move on the reactor now, but I want an evacuation team waiting for us when we get back.
Donrak checks his rifle, then turns to you with pure elation in his eyes.
Finally, a little bit of action, eh?
Shouldering his rifle, Donrak turns around and heads for the exit. He looks back over his shoulder and waves for you to join him. You don't know why, but for the first time since you've met him, his warm, charming smile turns your blood to ice.
That was Depths of Thule by Kevin Valbenesi. If you want to hear the rest of this story, please head on over to our Patreon page. You can find it by going to the website at twilighthistories.com and clicking on the Patreon link, or by going directly to patreon.com and running a search for Twilight Histories. Have a browse through all the Patreon content until you find Depths of Thule, and then fast forward until you find the right spot in the story. I warn you, you may get distracted by all the other content you see. There are tons of audio adventures only available to our patrons, going back to 2011. So, if you're a fan of the Twilight Histories, you will discover plenty of fantastic shows to unlock, and you'll be busy for a long, long time. The value is there. Come join us on Patreon. I'm Jordan Harbour. Thanks for listening to the Twilight Histories. Until next time, take care.